Hi, this is ANC Report. I'm Ryan Dawson. Today I'm speaking with Carl Dininger, the former CEO of MCSNet in Chicago and the founder and contributor to the financial blog MarketTicker.org. He wrote the book Leverage: How Cheap Money Will Destroy the World. But today we're going to talk about thorium and energy policy, which might seem like a scientific issue rather than an economic or political one, but actually it's all of the above. We're also going to cover a social issue whereby people allow themselves to be suckers of fear-mongering media salesmen and the effect that has on policy. Mr. Dininger, welcome aboard. I'd like to start very basic because I'm not sure how familiar people are with thorium and ask you, what is thorium and what can it be used for?
Thorium is a naturally occurring element in the Earth's crust. It is a metal. So, if you look at it, you would see something that looks like any other metal. It's shiny, it's hard. It is fertile, which means that it is capable of being turned into a nuclear fuel by bombarding it with neutrons. It is not fissile by itself. The difference between the two is that a fissile material will split when it is struck by neutrons and produce energy. A fertile material has to first capture neutrons and then it transmutes itself into a fissile material. So that's the distinction between the two. It's also in a number of places that we wish it really wasn't. It's a trace element in the Earth's crust, but it is in places such as naturally occurring in cold deposits. And the reason that this is important is that thorium, by its nature, occasionally emits an alpha particle, which is essentially a helium nucleus. And alpha radiation is extremely damaging. You may remember that a few years ago there was a gentleman that was poisoned by giving him polonium, and there are people who believe that Yasser Arafat was poisoned by giving him polonium.
Right, that was Litvinenko in the United Kingdom.
And polonium is an artificially occurring material that is used in smoke detectors because it emits alpha particles, and that becomes very useful for detecting smoke, which is why they use it in smoke detectors. But if you ingest it and get it into your body, alpha particles are large and therefore very effective in causing cancer. They're almost harmless, though, in the natural environment because your skin blocks them. So thorium, although it is an alpha emitter, if I was to pick up a ball of it and hold it in my hand, it wouldn't do anything bad to me. If I ate it would be a poison that would kill me, not just from
As
heavy
with
metal.
most metals.
Well, yeah, not just from heavy metal poisoning, though, but also from the radiation. And the other thing, though, that's interesting about it from that context, and the reason I bring it up in relationship to coal, is that because it naturally occurs in coal, when coal is burned, that is what's actually responsible for most of the lung cancers that are caused by coal-fired power plants. Because that gets into the atmosphere, you breathe it in, and now it's in your lungs.
So thorium would be environmentally superior to coal. What are the advantages of thorium also towards, say, a uranium or plutonium power plant?
There are a number of them. One of the more interesting aspects of its connection to coal, and the reason I brought it up originally, is that there is 13 times as much energy in coal in the form of thorium that we throw away. Most of it goes into the ash pile, the rest goes into the atmosphere and causes cancers, as there is from burning the coal. So we're rather foolish to just toss all of this on the ground, quite literally. But thorium in a reactor has a number of interesting properties. The United States in the 1950s and 60s, when we all thought that the US and Russia were going to blow each other to bits, was trying to figure out how to power an airplane with a nuclear reactor. Now, that sounds kind of insane. And in fact, it was insane. The project ultimately was abandoned because the shielding necessary to avoid killing the crew made it impractical. It just weighed too much. But in the process of doing this, they messed around with using thorium as a fuel. And the way they were intending to do this was by dissolving the thorium in a salt made out of a liquid form of fluoride. And that allowed the reactor to run without having a solid core. So the fuel was actually part of the coolant in the primary system. And you'd think, well, why would you want to do something crazy like that? And the answer is that this reactor is capable of running at a much higher temperature. Typical water-cooled reactors run somewhere around 350 degrees Celsius. And the reason they do that is that water doesn't stay liquid beyond what's called its critical temperature, which is around 500 C. And the important factor there is that you use water as a moderator. In other words, water is used to slow down the neutrons and keep the reaction going. But of course, as we saw in Fukushima, that has some bad properties, because in order to keep the water as a liquid, you have to keep it under extremely high pressure at those kinds of temperatures. And if anything goes wrong with that, because you can't circulate the water quickly enough, you lose electrical power to your pumps, or if there's a break in the pipe somewhere, now you've got a problem because the water all boils off into steam. This puts the reaction out, but now you can't manage to displace the heat that's necessary to keep the reactor safe, and you have the kind of incident that we had over in Japan. A liquid thorium-based fuel works a little bit differently because the fuel is dissolved in a salt that doesn't boil. And so the reactor runs at a much higher temperature. It's much more thermally efficient, and that's very important from a standpoint of the quality of the energy that you get out of it. But in addition to that, it's passively safe because it doesn't rely on extremely high pressures in order to maintain its safety margins. We ran one of these at Oak Ridge for about 4 years, including a year at full power. And the curious part of how they turned this thing off at the end of the week when they were done doing their experiments for the week and they just wanted to go home is that they literally just shut the lights off and went home. The reactor kept its liquid coolant in the vessel via the means of active refrigeration. They refrigerated a little plug of the material, and salts, of course, as you know, with table salt, it's a solid at lower temperatures. It turns into a liquid at higher temperatures. So you turn the refrigerator off and the plug melts. The coolant and fuel drain into a tank, and because there is no moderator, the reaction stops. No muss, no fuss, no active cooling, no need for pumps, none of this. They come back on Monday morning. They heat the fuel back up because now it's a solid. It's like a rock. Mm-hmm. And pump back into the reactor, it starts making energy again. The other interesting part of this is that because fluorine and fluoride compounds are so active, if you have a pipe break and it gets into the environment, let's say that you have something go wrong and some of the fluid leaks onto the floor of the reactor vessel, it solidifies and tends to self-contain itself. Now, this doesn't mean that that's not dangerous. It is. It's full of reaction products, and it makes a lot of radiation and is very hazardous to anybody that happens to be around. Of course, it would kill them just like any other reactor's fuel would. But it does mean that containing an accident becomes considerably simpler and less expensive to clean up. There are reasons why we didn't pursue this. There are engineering challenges.
Well, let me add something before we get into why we didn't do it. Is if I got this right, since another advantage, if you don't need high pressure because you're not using the water because you have the salts, then you don't have to be next to a large body of water either, which would mean for the Daiichi plants in Fukushima, for example, they wouldn't have needed to be near the water. They could have been moved inland into a safer location away from tsunamis had they had thorium as an option.
Yeah, but that's not the reason for that. It's using water as a moderator and a coolant, that isn't the reason per se that you know that they need it for the cooling purposes. The reason you can locate a thorium-based reactor away from large bodies of water is that because it operates at such a much higher temperature, about 650 degrees Celsius as opposed to a little over 300, it is more thermally efficient. And so you don't need, you can theoretically at least use an air-to-air heat exchanger, and you don't need water in order to get acceptable efficiency ratios. The reason they do put them right next to large bodies of water with current technology and what we're using today is because the thermal efficiency of a heat engine, no matter what generates the heat, is determined by the difference in Kelvin between the input temperature and the output temperature. So if you start with 300 degrees Celsius, which is about 573 Kelvin, because Kelvin is 273 plus Celsius, and you end up, can't be any lower than 0 Celsius, because of course water turns into ice at zero, then you have an inherent efficiency between those two temperatures. If you start with 650 degrees Celsius, you have a much higher starting temperature. Therefore, you could use air as a medium for the heat exchange rather than water and get an acceptable efficiency at the other end. But yes, this does, among other things, allow you to put the reactors in places that do not have ready access to huge volumes of water.
Why was this not pursued, or why was it abandoned after it was pursued?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Technically, there are some difficulties from an engineering perspective in using this. One of them is that the material itself, the coolant, liquid salts, are, as you imagine, quite corrosive. If you live near the ocean, you know this. It tends to corrode everything it comes in contact with. So you need to use fairly exotic metals made out of a material called hastelloy for the piping, and that stuff's kind of expensive. But it doesn't have to contain a lot of pressure, so there's the counterbalance to the cost, whereas a steel containment vessel for a water-based reactor, of course, has to be extremely thick and has to maintain a very high amount of pressure, and therefore that adds to the cost of going that route. But the other reason is that we had in the United States a very strong desire to both develop nuclear weapons and also to use the offshoot of that technology to provide power in the military environment. The weapons angle is kind of interesting in and of itself, in that a thorium-based reactor produces fission products that have a poison in them for weapons use. It's an isotope of uranium that is extremely undesirable to have in an atomic bomb. And the reason it's undesirable is that it produces a lot of gamma emission, which means that it kills anybody that tries to work on the bomb. So you would have to get that out of there before you could make bombs with the material that it produces. And that's difficult to do. It's an isotopic separation, much like what Iran is doing right now, as opposed to a chemical separation that is the case for plutonium. And because it's very difficult to do and expensive, you wouldn't choose a process that would have that as part of the procedure if you had other alternatives. And we did it. The other thing that goes along with this, though, which is greatly unappreciated, is that the military very much wanted to convert both our surface ships and submarines, large surface ships anyway, to nuclear power plants. For submarines, the reason is pretty obvious. If you don't have to surface all the time to recharge batteries, then your submarine becomes very hard to detect. And if you're trying to build nuclear missile submarines, you obviously don't want your enemy to find them, because they'll blow them up before you can use them. So
that's part of the Nautilus project from the 50s.
Exactly. Yeah. This was Rick Over in the Nautilus project. But the problem is that the small compact reactor, which is what you need for a submarine, because of course submarines have size problems, runs on essentially the same kind of nuclear fuel that you'd put in a bomb. Uses a highly enriched uranium core that frankly is quite suitable for weapons use. And the reason that it does that is simply based on size. A commercial power reactor is enormous, but you can't fit something like that in a sub. So we went down this direction because we got the benefit of dual use. We were able to use the same technology in general, both for civilian power production and for military purposes, and we only had to build one set of infrastructure to support both.
So it was more political than scientific reasons for why they chose that one.
It was a desire to get the most bang for the buck, and of course this, you know, is in the context of a period of time where we all thought we were going to blow each other up.
Right. But now, with the Soviet Union gone, what's the excuse for continuing? I mean, the U.S. isn't building any new plants anyway, but around the world, and Japan shut its power off, there are other emerging countries, India, etc. Would they be looking at thorium as a possible alternative?
Well, you would hope so. One of the things that I think is kind of interesting is that India is apparently experimenting with it as a fuel, but they're using it as a pebble bed fuel, which doesn't solve the heat control problems because you're still using water as a moderator in a coolant. The issues with with using a liquid salt-based fuel are primarily due to the fact that you have to reprocess the fuel in an online environment. In other words, the actual reprocessing pretty much has to take place during the operation of the unit, and it has to be done on site. And the reason is that as the reaction progresses, there are things that are produced in that reaction that are neutron poisons. They soak up the neutrons that cause the reaction to work. And if you don't get them out of there, eventually the reactor shuts itself down. But the other side of that is that unlike most reactors, Fukushima and the other water-based reactors, those reactors produce a very large amount of high-level radioactive waste because they're inefficient in that they don't burn up most of that, the first-level byproducts that are produced from the reaction itself. So in the United States, we stopped reprocessing fuel for political reasons. Jimmy Carter shut it off completely. But by the way, he was a trained nuclear engineer. He knew exactly what he was doing, that doing this would essentially kill the nuclear industry in time because there'd be no way to deal with the waste products. Ronald Reagan reversed that order, but the damage from a commercial perspective had already been done. Nobody's going to invest in something that could have their investment turned into dust by order of a president. So we no longer have the ability to reprocess in this country because we've made an executive and political level decision we're not going to do that. With a liquid thorium-based reactor, that reprocessing is done on site. But the side effect of this, the beneficial side effect, is that the final waste products that come out of the unit are, the high-level wastes, are only about 5% of what you get from a conventional uranium-powered unit. So the waste problem is essentially eliminated. The rest of the nasty byproducts are actually burned up in the process of running the reactor. So there are technological and engineering challenges in commercializing the technology. We proved that the reaction cycle and the actual stability of the device is functional, but the engineering challenges have not been addressed, and it would take a significant amount of time and of course money to resolve those challenges and build something that could be cookie cutter replicated, much as we do today with a lot of the light water stuff that we use in today's world.
And you said that thorium's naturally occurring with coal. How much more prevalent is thorium than, say, uranium, which I know is pretty rare?
Tremendously so. In fact, while it is considered a rare earth element, there is enough thorium in coal alone to provide all of the world's electrical energy resources, even considering our population growth rates, for somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 1,000 years. And that's just extracting it from coal. That's not getting it from anywhere else. The other interesting aspect of doing this, if we were to go down this path, is that coal can be turned into liquid fuels, gasoline and diesel. The Germans perfected this technology, of course, during World War II. It's called the Fischer-Tropsch process. It's what they used to provide their tanks and airplanes with fuel during the war because they didn't have any naturally occurring petroleum they could tap. The amusing part of this this little system and the abundance of thorium within coal deposits means that we could take the thorium out of the coal, turn the coal into synthetic fuel, use the remaining energy from the thorium reaction to produce electricity. And in doing so, we would not increase our coal consumption at all, but we would replace all of our fossil fuel extraction for gasoline and diesel fuel purposes. We'd have all the energy, the electrical energy that we get from burning coal today, and this would be a stable power source for the next 500 years.
Now, but and that's just you meaning the United States? The United States, I think,
is
50%
right,
of their electric
the
is coal only, yeah.
Right, that's just within the U.S. That's not looking at international supplies at all. If you look at international supplies, it's there, of course, is even more.
Sure, but the U.S. has, I think, 50, 51 or so in there, about percent of the electricity is from coal. So over half of their total electricity could be replaced by the thorium that's in coal that they're already using.
Yeah, we could essentially completely get rid of coal as an electrical generation source. The interesting part of doing this is that for those people that are CO2 believers that this is, you know, this is the cause of global warming and our imminent destruction. Doing this would cut anthropologic CO2 emissions by about 50%, because while we would still emit the coal's CO2 when we burned it as gasoline and diesel fuel, we wouldn't be emitting any from the burning of oil coming out of the ground. So we would essentially cut our CO2 emissions in half by going down this path as well.
Sure, and doomsday predictions or not, it's always good to not pollute if you can. You don't have to be a believer. It's good in and of itself to cut down on pollution. And I assume that would lower prices for gas and diesel too, because you'd have more of it than before, since you're using the coal that you would have burned up to make electricity.
Well,
I don't know if that would make a dent in it or not. I don't know the ratio between how much we use for gasoline versus what we use for electricity, but it'd have to be on the plus side somewhat.
Yeah, it would. In terms of cost, the issue with regards to this is not so much the instantaneous price as it is the stability. It's relatively easy for people to adjust what they do from an economic perspective if they have a decent handle on what the cost of input is going to be over time. It's much harder when the price of fuels and energy sources fluctuate by enormous amounts. If you look at what happened to the price of oil, for example, in 2007 and 2008, when it peaked at about $140 a barrel, the speed of change was enormous. And that caused a huge problem for people throughout the economy, both consumers and industry. What's going on now in Japan is a similarly huge problem, because with all of the nuclear generation shut down, Japan has gone from being a major exporting nation on balance to one that now has a trade deficit. The economic impact of that is incalculable, and yet this sort of self-inflicted injury happens all the time when you use something that doesn't have any inherent stability to it.
And Japan has to import about 99% of all its oil and coal, and Shinzo Abe is inflating the yen on purpose, so they're simultaneously making imports more expensive while they turned off their nuclear power and are forced to buy more from outside for oil and coal.
Yeah, and there's another interesting aspect to using thorium for this, and that is that Fischer-Tropsch just demands some sort of carbon as an input. So if you can stomach the price, you could actually condense carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and use that as an input to make your diesel fuel and your gasoline. In today's world, you wouldn't like the cost of doing that. But in terms of technological capacity, it can be done. So you've essentially built yourself an infrastructure that has the ability to provide what you need for motor fuels and such on an indefinite forward basis. And people need to understand, we don't use gasoline and diesel fuel because we're pigs. We use it because there is really nothing else that gets 110,000 BTUs in the size of a 1 gallon can. Oil is just a battery. And it just happens to be a battery that's charged over very long periods of time by the sun. When you're using something like that, it really just comes down to energy density. And there isn't any technological solution on the horizon that gets anywhere close to the density of what you get with liquid petroleum.
Thank you for pointing that out. And one of my other pet peeves is the people who believe we can run a car on water. And by that, they actually mean the hydrogen from water. And they're missing the step of extracting the hydrogen, which also requires fossil fuels.
Yeah, it's, you know, people think that because we stick a straw in the ground and we pull oil out, that this is, you know, other than the cost of putting the straw in the ground, that the energy is free. It's not. The sun put that energy there over millions of years. Everything that we use as an energy source has a cost. And when it comes to the propulsion of things on roads or things on rails or ships across water or whatever have you, what you're really concerned about is the amount of energy that you can store in a given mass and volume. And there just isn't anything other than liquid hydrocarbons that is competitive, and there isn't likely to be in the near to immediate future.
That's right. So, but if we can replace some other power source for electrical needs, not for moving ships and boats and cars and trains, but if we can use something else like thorium or some kind of nuclear power for that, at least we can subtract that amount from what we're using in fossil fuels for mobility and vehicles. And I'm wondering today, what are the challenges politically against building thorium in the United States, for example?
Well, the biggest challenge is that it has the word nuclear in it.
right.
I mean, the reality that people don't want to deal with is that humans in general have a very bad record of understanding what are called tail risk events. In other words, things that are very bad if they happen, but have a very low probability of happening. And yet we accept diffuse but much worse risks on a daily basis and go through our daily lives without giving a second thought to them. You get in your car and you go drive to the store. There is a much higher chance that you will be killed by somebody that hits you in your vehicle than that you will be killed by a nuclear accident of any kind, including from these less safe and more prolific reactors that we use today. It is extremely unlikely that such an accident will ever have a bad personal impact on the outcome of your life. If something does go wrong, though, it's going to create very bad outcomes for a large number of people all at once. But over time, you know, we look at this and we say, well, you know, Jesus, is really terrible what happened to Fukushima Daiichi. And it is terrible. And there is probably some culpability to go around with some of the information that we have learned over time as this has progressed. However, how many thousands of people have died from lung cancer because we burned coal for electrical power instead when we could have been using nuclear power? And the number of people that have died due to nuclear accidents in the United States can be counted on the fingers of your hand. Now, you know, are there places where things have gone really, really bad, in Japan or, for that matter, Chernobyl? Yes. However, when you look at the number of people that die every single year from asthma and from lung cancer as a consequence of the alternatives, the balance is clearly towards nuclear power. And yet politically, it's almost impossible to get anybody to even talk about it.
Well, in Japan, it was the tsunami that killed everybody, not the accident at the plants in Fukushima.
Right.
I mean, that was an economic cost, and they had to turn the nuclear power off. But nobody actually died of radiation or anything. We had three deaths, I think, from workers at the site. But that it wasn't from that. But the tsunami did kill about 20,000 people, and that was awful. But that was a once every 1,000 years kind of event. I mean, Japan has earthquakes, I don't know, hundreds every year. And there are tsunamis sometimes. But that one was very unusual, but it was the water physically that did the damage, not the nuclear plants.
Yeah, well that's the problem, is that, you know, when you look at the risks, there certainly are risks in all forms of technology. But what we need to keep in mind, and what everybody needs to keep in mind, in the general sense in our society, is that behind every unit of economic output, behind every dollar or yen of GDP, there is a unit of energy. It requires 10 times as much energy to make 10 TVs as it does to make one TV. So, or cameras or cars or whatever. So if we want to have economic progress and we want to have economic stability, we have to have energy progress and energy stability. And if we do not solve the energy stability problem, we are constantly going to have the tail wagging the dog instead of the other way around. And this is something that we've known how to solve for decades, and for political reasons have refused to do. The other technology that was kind of interesting in the nuclear space, and which before I started looking at thorium, I was very much in favor of, was the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. We ran one as a commercial power generating plant at Monroe in Michigan, on Rico Fermi. That used liquid sodium as a coolant, and it was also very efficient in burning up fuel and was a breeder, made more fuel than it consumed. The problem with it is that liquid sodium is extremely volatile. If you have an accident and it gets into the atmosphere, it immediately catches on fire. So, you know, there's obviously undesirable characteristics with that particular plant. In fact, that plant very nearly had a catastrophic failure when I was a young boy. But it is all about risk. And when you get down to it, there is no such thing as a free lunch, but nuclear energy is the largest and most dense source of power that we have available to us. And while it does have risks, we have to accept risk in our lives if we want to have progress.
Well, also the risk from coal and what we're using now is inevitable. I mean, that just happens. You got 100% chance of radon and other things going in the air and upping the odds for cancer.
Well, yeah, and the thing that goes with this is when you look at coal power plants, the fact of the matter is that while you can get a lot of the effluent out of the smoke, you can't get it all out. And unfortunately, some of the things that are in coal include some radioactive elements such as thorium, which is where the cancer risk comes from. And if we're going to use coal as a power source, then we have to accept that. But we've been, I guess what really infuriates me is we've been accepting that risk for over 100 years since we started using coal commercially as a means of generating energy, whether it be to power steam locomotives or whether it be to directly fire boilers or whether, you know, then today we use it mostly to generate electrical power. And we suffer the inefficiencies of this conversion into an energy that's convenient for us, in this case, electricity. And yet we have alternatives that on a per watt generated are less dangerous, and we refuse to use them because we're irrational.
Yeah, are people just, is it only irrationality or also just ignorance? Because I think most people don't really know anything about it, but they're scared of the word nuclear anyway. They've heard the scare story, so I think it might be a bit of both.
Well, it's ignorance, but it's ignorance driven by intentional fear-mongering. There's a very large contingent, both in the media and in the so-called alternative media on the internet, that just delights in putting up alleged stories that may be factually true, but they're utterly bereft of context. Okay.
They're not always even factually true. Just as someone that lives in Japan, I can tell you, almost every day I'll have somebody say to me, you need to get out of there. There's radiation everywhere, and they'll show me these maps, which were color maps of the wave after the tsunami on 3/11. That's why it's all in the water, not on the land, and how it's gone all the way to the United States and so on. And someone just switched the photoshopped around and said this is radiation instead of waves. And right. You can debunk that over and over again, and it doesn't matter. I mean, we're dealing with people that think HAARP in Alaska is an earthquake machine. So when you get people that strung up by fear, there's no way to reason with them because they weren't really reasoned into it. So it's hard to reason them out of it. So I know what you're saying about the fear factor, especially in the so-called independent media, but. Yeah,
it's pretty it gets pretty disgusting sometimes. One of the things that I've gotten very upset with people on my forum is in the conversations on the Fukushima Daiichi incident. One of the things that some people love to run is this idea that taking the fuel rods out of there and draining the pools and getting the de-risking the plant basically now that the incident has happened. Is something that is inevitably going to lead to a accidental criticality, and we're going to have a runaway reaction with no containment building, and everybody's going to die. And I keep trying to point out to people that engineers spend thousands of hours when they build these plants, when they originally specify them, guaranteeing that the geometry of the fuel in the reactor is correct for the reaction to work. And that without the geometry being exactly correct, nothing happens. So is it theoretically possible for there to be an accident of this sort? Yes, because there is water there and water is the moderator. But is it likely to happen? And the answer is, oh, heck no. All right. And so, everybody looks at this and says, well, but, this and this source says this. And yet when you look at the facts, if you have any kind of formal training or have done any study on this stuff, you come to the conclusion these people are just out of their mind and trying to scare the bejesus out of the public.
Yeah, I could name them, but I'm not gonna. But it's usually from the same few charlatans. And I don't know if how sincere they are about it, if they fool themselves or what, or they're just trying to make a dollar off sensationalism, which is what I tend to believe. But they've really scared people, and this has really hurt tourism in Japan, and it's hurt Japan as a whole, because the Japanese public wasn't immune to this either, and they turned off all but one reactor. The KEPCO one in the west near Osaka was still on, but they've, because of the fear of nuclear power, they turned them off. And also because of that, the political party that was in charge at the time of the tsunami is out. The LDP got in, and these ultra right wing, kind of nuts like Hashimoto and company are in power now, because they ran on this one issue pony of we're going to turn the nuclear power off, and people didn't see the other issues and how horrible they were about getting very close to, tensions over Sankaku and other issues with China and Korea and things that took so many years to resolve, and now we're back at ground zero. And that's sort of the political side effect from the ignorance of energy policy and basic science. So there's a lot of real damage that have been done by these people trying to make a dollar off of scaring everybody.
Yeah, it's kind of amusing, because I have on my desk a very high quality recording Geiger counter. I've had it here for a long time, and it gives me a very nice count of what the background radiation level looks like. And throughout all of this time, despite all the people telling me that I'm getting irradiated and I'm going to die, the background level hasn't moved at all. It's literally not at all. And if there is such a contamination in the sea, and therefore it's all in the seafood, and by the way, the one I have will read alpha, which is the type of particles the hardest to pick up. How come I can't find it in any of the food that comes in my house?
Right. I actually had a man from Germany come to Japan with his Geiger counter to prove me wrong, and he went to Tokyo and Osaka, and he found less radiation in Japan than he did in Europe, which was zero, yeah, basically, for both. Forbes did a report. It's about the same radiation level as 76 million bananas.
Yeah, well,
it sounds big.
Well, that's
it,
the other thing. Yeah, that's the other thing that's kind of interesting too, is that I have a bunch of bananas on my kitchen counter, and there's more radioactive potassium in them than there is in anything else in the house.
Right.
So.
Well, is there a way to ease people's tensions about that? Because people say, well, you're in energy, you're trying to sell something, but I'm not at all. But they, or, oh, you live in Japan, so you're biased or something. There's always some excuse, but is there some way to combat such irrational fear about nuclear power? I mean, I know you've talked to enough people about it. Have you found any methods that work better than others?
Not really. Unfortunately, it's some of this is cultural. Some of it is driven by what happened in the 1950s and 1960s. And of course, I when I was a young boy and first started school, they were still doing duck and cover drills in kindergarten. So you still had us dive under our desk and grab our privates.
Like, that's going to help.
Yeah, that doesn't help a lot with regards to what gets ingrained into your head, right?
Right.
So I think, what it comes down to is that the more educated you get, people all the time run around try to tell me, well, any amount of radiation is bad and there isn't any. And so, we're putting it in the environment. It's awful. And if they come over to my home, I pull a little Geiger counter out from behind my monitor, which is where I normally keep it, because it's got an alarm that'll go off if anything bad happens. And I set it on the desk, and it flashes every now and then. And I thought, well, that was an incident of radiation. That was an incident of radiation. Every time it flashes. And they look at me and go, what? I said, oh, yeah, you're exposed to it right now. Well, we got to get out of here. Well, wait a minute. Would you like to go outside? It's the same thing. You want to go over to the next city? It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And the incidence that we have here in this immediate area where I live is about 25% lower than the national average for America. Mm-hmm. So where would you like to go? do you get in an airplane? Well, you this thing will be flashing like mad because of the cosmic radiation. It's 50 times the dose when you're on an airplane and taking a flight.
Now you're going to scare people out of flying. No.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, I mean, you know, I go to the dentist and they take an X-ray of my teeth, and that's ionizing radiation. So, I mean, there's no way to avoid risk. We need to look at things from a relative point of view. And I just point at all the people that die from asthma and lung cancer that is not caused by your own personal smoking, right, which is, of course, most of it, but those people who don't. And then I say, okay, you know, of all those thousands of people that are going to die this year, how many people has nuclear energy killed in the last 10 years? And the answer is, you know, you can count them, but they're not nuclear accidents per se. For the most part, there's some guy that fell off a crane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm preaching to the choir. I hear you, but it needs to be said, and I hope people can hear this conversation and maybe calm down a little bit. There's no benefit for either of us to want people to die from radiation or anything. We're just giving you the simple facts and odds, and there really isn't much to worry about. And I hope.
Well, I've long said that if they start building thorium plants or even conventional plants, if it means that the smoke belching coal power plant gets turned off, you can put one next door to my house.
Sure, and you have something that's no longer dual use for nuclear bombs, uranium, which is also being used in warfare.
Yeah, if there's if something goes wrong and there's an accident and I die, well, then, you know, that happens. But I'm trading one risk for another, and this alternative is a lower risk than what I'm dealing with and accepting right now.
Well said. Well, I don't know if our Congress are ever going to listen, but we can do this in baby steps through education and start talking about some other alternatives, because the writing's on the wall, not only for price stability, but environmental reasons too. And I hope I can translate this talk in Japanese and spread it around here as well, because electric prices are insane since they turned the nuclear energy off.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'd love to come back and visit Japan again, but you need to tell Abe that until he stops manipulating his currency, he's made it too expensive for me to consider.
Actually, that would be a fun show to do too, if you want to rip on Abe with me. I'd love to do that. He's Abenomics. I know it looks like Abe in English, or ABE, but
I know.
Yeah, that's about right. He doesn't even deserve the courtesy of his name. But yeah, he's been elected twice. It blows my mind. It's so sad, but that's another topic entirely. The stupidity of inflating your currency on purpose. I guess you think it's just, I don't even know where to start on how bad that's been. But if you're making dollars, it's a good time to come to Japan, although there's problems with the dollar as well. But it will be cheap to come to Japan if you're a foreigner now. It's dumbness, so, ignorance all around us on every issue.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, there's this common chestnut here in the United States of what we call low information voters. And unfortunately, it's a worldwide phenomenon. I don't know that there is a short-term solution to this, but one of the realities that people need to face is that ignorance is expensive, and it is frequently personally expensive, because you get exploited by people who will use your ignorance and your willful blindness against you. Those who think that this is something that is just a bunch of elites need to understand that it's very difficult to rip off an educated person that uses their head. It's very easy to steal from you if you refuse to be skeptical and ask for evidence, and in fact, in cases like this, strict proof.
Exactly. Ignorance isn't bliss. Ignorance is expensive.
That's right. So, you know, you get to choose how expensive you want it to be by what you choose to do.
It's hard to up that lowest common denominator, which happens in a democratic system. We've got all these problems with, you know, the giant ripoff of $16 trillion from the bailouts, plus the Federal Reserve's own bailouts. We have wars. We have conflict in Syria. We have conflicts in Africa. We have drone attacks and all these problems. And the issue at hand last time around was gay marriage.
Well, you know, here's the thing that I keep trying to tell people, have been for the last 6.5, 7 years when I started publishing the ticker. And that is that interest rate manipulation, including quantitative easing, there are people that seem to think, well, you know, this is good because you can buy a car or a house and you pay less interest. Okay, Somebody lent you the money to buy the car or the house. And for every dollar that you save in interest, they get $1 less. So all that has happened is that you have taken money from one pocket and put it in the other. And if I take a $20 bill out of my left pocket and put it in my right, I am not $20 more wealthy. And yet on a economic basis across the entire economy, that's all this has done. So you've essentially just stolen money from one person and given it to somebody else. The net impact over time of these policies is zero.
Well, actually, it's worse than that because not all of it was interest-free either.
Well, of course. There's no free lunch. This is another thing that goes with thermodynamics and, you know, what we were talking about earlier. All processes involve loss. There is no such thing as a free lunch. You can't even break even. That's the most important thing to remember, is that you can't break even. Everything has a cost.
Exactly. Well, and the most costly thing may be ignorance itself. So
yes,
that's why we do these programs on all these different topics and try it to reverse that as much as we can. So again, thanks for coming on, and do come to Japan sometime. Give a talk. I'd love to go see that.
All right, thanks. Take care.
Take care.
That was Carl Dininger. You can see his work at marketticker.org. Hopefully I'll have him back on the program again soon to talk about the financial subjects, maybe the Japanese yen, maybe bitcoins, we'll see. So stay tuned, and please donate if you can. Every little bit helps. The more you give, the more I can give. That's how it works. Thanks for listening today. See you soon.